This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Carlson Fish Oils. Fish oil provides the vital omega-3s, EPA and DHA, which support cardiovascular, brain and nerve, vision, immune system, joint, and skin health. Carlson ensures maximum freshness by managing their fish oils from sea to shelf. All Carlson fish oils are tested by an FDA-registered laboratory for freshness, potency, and purity, and they're available in soft gels and liquid form. For more information, go to carlsonlabs.com. Carlson fish oils are available at fine health food stores nationwide. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk about a fascinating new book. The book is entitled The Longevity Plan, Seven Life-Transforming Lessons from Ancient China. It's written by today's guest, Dr. John Day, and co-written with his wife, Jane Ann Day, along with Matthew LaPlante. And it's a fascinating look at an American physician's visit to a bucolic village in China and the wisdom that he brought back. And there are a lot of lessons about intelligent medicine that we can learn from that book. So let me introduce our guest. First of all, Dr. John Day is a cardiologist, and he's board certified in that field. He's also gone on to a subspecialty within cardiology. He's medical director of heart rhythm specialists at the Intermountain Medical Center in Salt Lake City, Utah. He received his medical degree from a prestigious source, Johns Hopkins University, and then went on to complete his cardiology training at one of America's top programs at Stanford University. And he's published more than 100 medical studies, given lectures throughout the world on heart-related topics. With that introduction, first of all, welcome, Dr. Day. It's a pleasure having you on Intelligent Medicine.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I love your podcast and the great work that you're doing.
Well, thank you for joining us. So with that introduction, I think people realize that you are not coming from a holistic medicine perspective necessarily. You were in the belly of the beast. You spent years and years of medical study and then postgraduate study learning about heart rhythms. You published papers on technical subjects that probably are too difficult for the average person to even understand. And yet you sought to learn practical lessons by going to a small mountain village in China. So how did that come to pass?
You know, that's a great question. And it really was my own challenges that I faced. And then at the same time, the challenges that so many of my patients were facing when medications, procedures, just we weren't making headway against a lot of these chronic cardiovascular issues, in particular atrial fibrillation. And so in my own life, I had this strange idea that as long as I was exercising, I was healthy. And it didn't matter what I ate. And unfortunately, my diet was about as bad as you can get from the standard American diet. Thanks to all the free food and the doctor's dining lounge of every hospital that I've ever worked at, you know, breakfast was a donut, a bagel, a cream cheese, a Diet Coke. Maybe lunch wasn't a whole lot better with a slice of pizza and Diet Coke. But I thought I was fine. I was exercising. Everything was going well until my mid-40s. And then it was almost suddenly overnight, I found myself with an autoimmune disease, eosinophilic esophagitis. I was overweight, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, felt awful. And it was hard to even do these long, tedious procedures or operations that we do, to play basketball with my children. I was really kind of at my wit's end trying to figure out where to go next.
Mm-hmm. And also, you know, paradoxically for a cardiologist and an athlete, according to the book, you developed two major risk factors, actually three, for cardiovascular disease, so overweight, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol. And you, better than all people, really know that, you know, that's a recipe for disaster.
Oh, sure. But, you know, when you're in the middle of it, you're busy, you're rationalized, you don't have much time, everybody around you is doing it, and they seem to appear okay, but you really don't know what's going on. And I think a lot of people are that way. You can get by until 30s, 40s, maybe if you're really lucky, you could make it to age 50, but sooner or later, you can't out-train a bad diet. Everything catches up with you. And it wasn't just that. It was the stress levels, compromising on sleep. I mean, there were a lot of factors that all kind of hit at once, which really pushed me to needing to find better solutions. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't want to be on prescription medications for the rest of my life.
And indeed, you know, a lot of people cite China as an example. You know, there's a book called The China Study, but some people have critiqued that book, basically saying that all is not too rosy in China. There's lots of pollution. Chinese are adapting to modernization with a Western diet. There's increased cardiovascular disease and obesity. So, you know, there are many different Chinas. There's, you know, downtown Beijing and Shanghai, and then there's longevity villages, these blue zones within China. And how did you come upon this place that you visited?
So as part of this journey, this struggle, I speak fluent Chinese. And so I'm often asked to give lectures at big cardiac conferences representing medical societies in China. And I think they liked having me there as one of the few Caucasians who can give his lectures in Chinese. Mm-hmm. And as I was meeting with people and talking with people and starting to open up and share some of the challenges that I was facing, they kept pointing me from multiple directions toward this longevity belt. And it right at the center of it is this Bapan village, which we study in the book, where people live these remarkably long, healthy lives, free of cardiovascular disease, cancer, arthritis, all these other conditions. And they're not just living, they're thriving to 100 and beyond. And so, you know, as I started to dig through the medical literature, there's a lot published on these people in the Chinese medical literature, and now more and more in the Western medical literature. It was really my wife who basically said, we're going, you know, we're taking our family, we're going, and let's get to the bottom of this and see what's really going on. But you bring up a good point. China is changing. The Beijing, Shanghais of the world have already changed, but it's even happening to these small little longevity pockets. And we really came at the perfect time as we were able to witness the end of the old ways, that traditional lifestyle, and really see them ushering into the modern world with processed foods, televisions, automobiles, everything along those lines. And what this village really had going for it was the geographic isolation. But about 10 years ago, they lost that, and they were no longer cut off from the rest of China and the rest of the world.
Indeed. And one of the features of this place, I mean, they in the book, you cite Sardinia as one of the blue zones. And there's quite a lot of people who live well into their hundreds, a lot of centenarians, which is a very unusual phenomenon. But you say that this place in China that you visited way, way outpaces Sardinia in terms of the percentage of centenarians in the population.
Indeed, this village, this area, this little county in China really has the highest percentage of centenarians in the world. Now, the data are a bit skewed in that, as most people or anyone familiar with modern China knows, is that most of the younger generation in these small rural farming communities have all migrated to the big cities of China to work in the sweatshops, to make our iPhones, our Gucci handbags, and all these other products that we enjoy in the West. And so as a result, the denominator is a bit skewed. The middle generation, the older generations tend to stay, but the younger generations go off in search of this fast-paced lifestyle with promises of big economic rewards.
Mm-hmm. So what are these villages like? Describe the way of life that you found in, and what was the name of the village that you visited?
So the village name is the Bapan Village, and these villages are definitely changing. Historically, they were villages in that it was very quiet. There weren't televisions, automobiles. automobiles, all these other modern conveniences. And the people subsisted on hand farming. They grew what they ate. They pulled fresh fish out of the river that went through it, and they ate a really clean, pure, natural diet. And being in a very rural area, they didn't have all the pollution issues and that plagued many parts of the world and many parts of China. And it was a really quiet place where they were very socially connected, and really all the stars were in alignment for longevity, as we go through in the book. Now, that's all changing, and they're quickly adopting our modern ways, as there's now a new highway going in, and things are changing.
Yeah, one of the things that you note in the book, which is, I think, really fascinating, is that you did a little bit of analysis, because one could argue that, okay, you know, the Chinese, they're not Americans. Americans may have genetic risk factors for cardiovascular disease that these centenarians don't have. So maybe our genes are our fate. But when you did some deep digging, you discovered something quite remarkable, didn't you?
Exactly. And you know, as a trained physician, scientist, and I approached this whole longevity village with a bit of skepticism, thinking, you know, it's a small village. They were cut off geographically. Sure, there must be some inbreeding. Maybe they, you know, somehow the stars were aligned and they got the perfect genetic deal in life. But as we analyze their DNA, and in our research team, we looked at the DNA of all these people, did extensive medical histories, medical examinations. We dug as deep as we could. And what we found is that their genes are really no different than ours. For example, the FOXO3 gene, which is one of the most well-studied genes for longevity, or the MNSOD gene, which codes for longevity, cancer, cardiovascular disease. What we found is that many of these centenarians had a genetic profile that would have predicted an early fate of cardiovascular disease, cancer, premature death, but it didn't happen. Their genes are no different than ours. What our conclusion was is it wasn't the DNA that they were dealt with, the genes that they had, but rather epigenetic factors. In other words, the daily lifestyle decisions that they made determined which genes got turned on and which genes got turned off. And it really is a message of hope that, you know, we don't have to look at, oh, it's just part of aging, it's our fate, but rather, we can control which genes, to a large extent, get turned on, which ones get turned off. And it just comes down to those small daily decisions that we have each and every day.
And I think that parallels a study, which I'm sure is well known to you, that I reported on to my listeners on Intelligent Medicine, which recently was in the New England Journal of Medicine, where they managed to do a real deep dive on many of the risk genes that determine obesity, perhaps hypertension, stickiness of the blood, inflammation. And they said maybe there were, you know, 50 of them approximately. And they looked at, they looked at a population. And they stratified them in terms of, you know, whether they had really bad genes, maybe not so bad genes, pretty good genes, or excellent genes. And what they found is that even if you had the worst tier of genes, if you had the quartile that was the worst combination of bad genes, the ones who ate well, didn't smoke, and did a modicum of exercise, that was very modest. It was like 3 hours a week or something along those lines, something very wussy. That those individuals were equivalent to average individuals. So it really argues for plasticity, for epigenetics, for our ability to take charge of our genetic fate and, in effect, modify the expression of our genes.
Exactly. And that study fits right in line with many twin studies. For example, studies looking at identical twins who share the same DNA, you know, the studies show that roughly 80% of our health, our happiness, and our longevity is really due to the daily lifestyle decisions that we make each and every day. Maybe 20% is due to genetic factors. So there really is a lot that's within our realm of control.
Well, so you went there and you were impressed and began a personal transformation. What was that like for you? What are some of the things that you changed in your life that have led you to, I mean, I see pictures of you and, you know, you look slim and trim and unstressed, and you know, clearly there have been some changes.
Certainly. And for me, probably the first area that I really needed to focus on was to clean up my diet and to get off of the standard American diet, to eat real food, to let food heal me of many of the conditions that I was facing. But it wasn't just that. There were many other factors as well. And we go through this in the book, changing your mindset, embracing stress instead of dreading stress. Being optimistic to the extent possible, connecting socially, real social connection, living in alignment with our, you know, circadian rhythm and some of these other factors, where prior to that, you know, it was almost as if life was a bit of a blur, just trying to get through the days, but trying to be intentional, mindful. And through this combination of everything that I had learned in the village, I was quickly able to turn my own life around, get off all five prescription medications. The weight came off naturally. Blood pressure dropped about 30 points. Cholesterol dropped in half. Autoimmune disease went into remission. Everything just went away. Some took longer than others, but over the course of a number of months, everything just went away and the medications were no longer necessary. And then as I started to apply that in the lives of my patients, I saw the same things. People who were on handfuls of medications, we were able to just keep whittling away at the medicines, and before long, they were off their medicines and free from their cardiovascular disease, had gone into remission. And it really was quite remarkable about how well our body is able to heal itself if we just give it a chance.
Yeah, that's amazing that you're able to achieve turnarounds with some of these very sick patients with advanced problems. So a lot of people, when they hear about, you know, this Chinese Shangri-La, you know, these types of places where people do really well, and that's sort of referencing the China study by T. Colin Campbell, their belief is that the diet has to be a vegetarian or quasi-vegetarian to be successful. Clearly, these people consumed lots of fresh vegetables and fruits. But does the diet have to be vegetarian? Do centenarians survive into their hundreds while eating moderate amounts of animal protein?
Well, that's a great question. And for anyone who understands the Chinese culture, their language, there's actually a saying in Chinese that the Chinese people will eat anything with two legs other than a human, and anything with four legs other than a table.
Wow.
The thing about this village is that these people were so poor. They went through decades of the Chinese Revolution, and then Chairman Mao took over with failed economic policies that left the entire country, and especially in this village and elsewhere, in the throes of starvation and famine. And so the only food that couldn't be taken from them was the food that came out of the ground, or the small little oily fish that we talk about in the book that came out of the river. Yeah, they would have loved to have eaten meat, but they were so poor. And if anyone were to come up with an animal, it would quickly be confiscated. And so other than the Chinese New Year, maybe weddings or other festivals, and at those times they would bring out a pig and they would eat the whole pig, nose to tail.
Right.
But outside of those special occasions, animal meat was largely absent from their diet, mainly because they just couldn't get their hands on it. Now fish, they would eat fish, these small oily fish, and once again, they eat the whole thing, the bones, the everything, get their calcium that way. They would eat these fish, you know, maybe once or twice a week. So yes, it was mostly plant-based, but it wasn't by choice. It was by survival.
So the difficulty of applying this to our American or Western model is that it requires some degree of deprivation. Actually, deprivation is an ingredient in longevity. And we know this from studies in roundworms, that caloric restriction, CR, it's called, is something that elongates telomeres and revs up certain longevity factors that that help people live longer and help, you know, virtually every creature in the animal kingdom survive longer.
You bring up a great point. And whether you're looking at flies, worms, or animals, you're right. Caloric restriction seems to promote longevity, whether it's through activation of longevity genes or other mechanisms. But you know, the beautiful thing is, I don't think anybody wants to go around always hungry. And the beautiful thing about this village is these people ate, and they ate more, and they ate as much as they wanted to. Nobody was on a diet. Nobody was counting calories. There were no shoulds, coulds, woulds, guilt, shame. They just ate real food and as much as they wanted to. And the beautiful thing is, if you're eating in line with your genome, you can eat huge amounts of foods and not gain weight and enjoy all the health benefits. Now, there are some fascinating data, which I'm sure you're well aware of and probably already covered on your podcast, about intermittent fasting and how intermittent fasting may activate those same longevity genes that you see with caloric restriction. Now, quite interestingly, here in this village, they practiced intermittent fasting every day without even thinking about it. It was just their culture to come in after a long day of hand farming out in the fields. They would come in, they would have a light and early dinner, and then they wouldn't eat again until the next morning. And so by eliminating that pre-bedtime snack, they might go 12 hours, 14 hours without any food, which studies show that going, you know, 12 or more hours without food is a form of intermittent fasting that activates those same pathways that caloric restriction may have. And so there's a lot of fascinating data around that, that you can have all of the benefits without having to deprive yourself.
So they weren't sitting around at 11:30 at night watching The Tonight Show with a bowl of Haagen-Dazs in their laps. They were, you know, the lights go low. No. There's not a lot to do. You're going to be getting up at the crack of dawn to harvest. And so you turn in, you know, probably following the dictum that, you know, don't eat much after about 7 o'clock.
Exactly. And they didn't have all that artificial light. And by working their bodies, being physically active during the day, when the sun went down, they were tired, and their bodies naturally drifted into sleep, and they slept very well and started all over again the next morning.
Great. Well, this is a good point at which to pause. We've certainly laid the groundwork for a discussion of the longevity plan. It's lessons derived from ancient China. And our guest is Dr. John Day, who has undergone a personal transformation and has done extensive research with multiple visits to a site in China where people often live well into their hundreds. So in part two, we're going to explore some of the other components of the longevity plan, dealing with stress, exercise, and so on. So let's pause and stay with us. When we return, more on the longevity plan with Dr. John Day. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.